Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Broders v. Heights.
May it please the court, Mr. John Martin will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I will present argument on behalf of all of the petitioners today. I would like to take just a few seconds to introduce my co-counsel from Thompson & Knight, Beverly Ray Burlingame, who is in the courtroom behind the rail. Ms. Burlingame and I represent the individual positions. Mr. Gerald Benson is seated to my left at the council table. Mr. Benson represents Presbyterian Hospital of Dallas. The issue in this case is whether or not Texas Rule of Evidence 702 allows any witness with a medical doctor degree to testify in a medical malpractice case about any medical subject whatsoever. We're here to argue to this honorable court that the answer to that question has to be no.
Isn't it a little bit more narrow than that, even whether Judge Hartman abused his discretion?
Well, that certainly is the nub of the issue, Justice Gorman. It is an abuse of discretion case. We contend most strongly that the trial judge...
The same issue that was in DuPont, abuse of discretion.
It is an abuse of discretion like DuPont versus Robinson, and I tend to call that case Robinson, so forgive me if I do that as we go along, but I believe that this case, like Robinson, is a case involving abuse of discretion. This is really the second half of the expert witness question that has to be answered. In Robinson, of course, the issue was, does the trial judge have a role as a gatekeeper in examining the scientific methodology and its reliability in evaluating the validity of expert testimony? A majority of this court answered that question in the affirmative. This case is really the front half of that question, and that is the threshold question of admissibility in terms of the qualifications of the expert under Rule 702.
So it doesn't make any difference to your argument before us what the trial judge did. In other words, if the trial judge had admitted this witness's testimony, you would still contend that was error.
In this case, on these facts, if Judge Hartman had admitted the testimony of Dr. Fred Kondo on cause and fact, we would be here making the same argument, and that is that he did not have the that it would have been an abuse of discretion on these facts to admit that testimony. Certainly, there are cases. There are many cases where there is a range of discretion.
This is not like the Robinson case where the majority strongly hinted that if the trial judge had let the evidence in, that would have been the end of it.
In that respect, this case is not like the Robinson case. I think that's correct. But I think the majority of this court has now recognized that the trial court, when it comes to expert testimony, does have this gatekeeper role, this gatekeeper responsibility in evaluating the scientific reliability of the testimony. Well, it seems to me that it's very obvious that if the trial court is supposed to go into the scientific methodology that the expert uses in arriving at a conclusion, then certainly the trial court has the discretion and, in fact, has the duty to examine the expert's qualifications to testify. And I think really in an indirect way, the dissenting opinion recognizes that in some language that we quoted in our brief. That the trial court has a function as a screener or a gatekeeper when it comes to the expert qualifications. Now, I'm sure the court is well aware of the facts. I'm not going to dwell on the facts, but I want to hit on a few key facts that I think are particularly important in this case. Kathy Heiss was walking home from her boyfriend's apartment in North Dallas, a distance of about 3 or 3.5 miles. On the evening of April 7th, 1988, when she was assaulted by an unknown man who, according to eyewitnesses, struck her on the neck or choked her. She was taken by paramedics to the emergency department at Presbyterian Hospital of Dallas, where she remained for slightly over 16 hours. During that time, she gave no history of having been hit on the head. No history of her having been hit on the head was reported by the paramedics. There was no physical sign of a head injury that was observed by any of the physicians. The only history that was given, the only mechanism of injury that was described was some red marks on the neck. The physicians initially were not even able to examine Ms. Heiss because she would not allow an examination. She was very uncooperative and admitted at some point in the evening to being under the influence of alcohol. There was no reason, according to the physician's testimony, to do a CAT scan during that admission. But what this case really boils down to is the plaintiff's allegation that a CAT scan, a CT scan, should have been performed during that first admission. She was released into the care of her boyfriend about 1:30 the following afternoon after a stay of about 16 hours. He took her to his apartment residence, kept her there that afternoon. Later on, in the early evening hours, she began to vomit and developed an excruciating severe headache, according to the boyfriend, very different display of symptoms than she had had before. She was brought back to the emergency room, seen by a different physician. A CAT scan was ordered, which revealed a basilar skull fracture. She died the following morning. The autopsy reported that she died as a result of craniocerebral injuries apparently sustained when she's assaulted. Both the autopsy and police report describe this event as a homicide. In other words, what we have is, although there was a delay between the initial assault and her death, what we have here is a murder.
Let me interrupt your facts real quick. Assuming we were to agree with you, the trial court correctly excluded the testimony in this case, and we were looking to articulate clearly a rule in these medical malpractice cases for trial courts and courts of appeal. You cited us language out of Van Zandt and language out of Mielke. Do you think that, and of course Rule 702, do we need to, can you think of a way that we could articulate the standard in these cases any more clearly? Or have we clearly enough articulated?
I think the Dallas Court of Appeals in its two decisions, Mielke versus Metney and Roberson versus Factor, do articulate the standard, and that is that under Rule 702, it's really just logical from reading Rule 702. It's really a two-element analysis. The first element is whether or not the expert possesses the training, skill, experience, etc., that gives him, quote, specialized knowledge about the very subject matter that's involved.
Well,
in the
of course, the emergency room physician has specialized knowledge as opposed to me or you. But is there any language that you would suggest that this court consider and that you would offer up to us, saying that this would clarify for the trial courts and for courts of appeal where the line should be drawn in medical malpractice?
Well, where I think some courts have missed the mark a little bit and have sort of muddied the water is this talk about if the expert brings more than a layperson knows. I don't think that should not be the test, and I don't think that is the test. And I think in Mielke versus Metney, Roberson versus Factor, they talk about specialized knowledge as being more than somebody who just knows more than a layperson knows. As a lawyer who handles a lot of medical cases, I suppose I know more than lay people about medicine, but I should not be able to testify as an expert witness. So I really think it's a two-part test, Justice Owen, and I think the first part is this requirement of specialized knowledge. And then I think the second part of the test is that it has to assist the trier of fact. And I really think that element has not been discussed as much in depth as it should have been, and I think this case really presents a great opportunity for the court to clarify that.
Well, let me take you to another issue in the case. Let's assume that we do not agree with you. We agree that it was error for the trial court to exclude this testimony. You have said in your brief that it doesn't really matter in this case because the plaintiff could not show harmful error because of the broad form of submission. How would you, in a case, how would you show where key testimony, the only testimony virtually on causation has been excluded, how would you ever show harmful error in a broad form submission case such as this?
Well, in this case, we've argued, and I realize the court didn't grant the writ on this point, but one of our points of error, which has been brought to this court, is that on these facts, that with that evidence having been excluded, that it was incumbent on the respondents, on the plaintiffs, to request a separate submission of negligence and proximate cause.
that it would not have been error for the trial court to deny that submission and to submit it as the trial court did.
We, if properly requested, we believe in this case it should have been submitted that way. It wasn't requested. No request was made.
You're saying it was an error for the trial court to deny a broad form submission in this case?
I would argue that if the plaintiff asked for it and the trial court denied it, that would be error.
On what basis?
Because on these facts, there was either no evidence or a very, very tiny bit of evidence on the causation issue. And the only way that a reviewing court can ever determine whether the jury believed there was no negligence or no proximate cause is to submit the issue separately.
So you're saying where it's a close call, it's error for the trial court to submit in broad form, but it's not a close call?
I don't think it's a question whether it's a close call. I think that in a case where it is requested, I think the trial court should submit the issue separately. And I realize this court has written many opinions endorsing broad form submissions.
Well, assuming that we would not go that route, and we were to say we have broad form submission and we're going to continue that practice in Texas, How would you propose that people preserve an error, a point of error, when you have exclusion of testimony that goes to an ultimate issue?
I don't see how the court could ever determine what the jury's answer meant, whether it was no negligence or no proximate cause. So I think in this case, in order to find harm, you'd have to look at the record as a whole. We've got another harmless error point, again, which the court did not grant, and that is that when you compare the very detailed testimony that we offered from two board-certified neurosurgeons, Dr. Sampson, called by the hospital, and Dr. Weiner, called by the physicians, explaining in detail the autopsy findings showing the deep white matter brain injury that this woman had that was undetectable on a CAT scan and that was detectable only on autopsy. That when you compare, and the fact that based on the injury that we now know that she had, that no treatment could have saved this young woman's life anyway. When you compare that with the magic word testimony of Dr. Kondo, which just goes straight to the bottom line conclusion there was no proximate cause, that's the testimony that Judge Hartman excluded. When you look at the record as a whole, there is no showing of harm here. Again, I realize that's a point the court did not grant the writ on. But I think it's important for the court to realize that in order to evaluate and analyze the cause and fact issue in this case, any medical doctor testifying about that issue would have to have some opinion of what the CAT scan that he says should have been ordered would have shown had it been done. There's nothing along those lines from Dr. Kondo. He then says a neurosurgeon should have been called. He doesn't know what a neurosurgeon would do when he got there. Well, again, that's a big missing evidence in the cause and fact picture here. We called two neurosurgeons who said if they'd been called, nothing could have been done short of making this woman comfortable. But nothing could have been done to save her life and that there was a 95% probability that she was going to die regardless of any intervention on the part of a neurosurgeon.
But isn't that a separate defense, the survival percentage?
Really, that's the Your Honor, that is the heart of the cause and fact issue.
Well, but your argument now is the second part of the two-part thing. Aren't you trying to zero in as the trial court's prerogative to determine the qualification and then from that determination decide how far this witness can go
right.
His or her testimony.
Well, that's certainly correct.
That's the first part that you're asking us to decide and to articulate a specific rule.
That's
what
right.
Would you propose the rule to be?
What I propose the rule to be is that the witness must have specialized knowledge on the particular subject matter that's involved in this case.
Would you then say that your whole argument is what Milkey versus Metley says on page 679. The person offered must possess special knowledge as to the very matter on which he proposes to give an opinion.
Exactly.
Is that it?
Exactly.
So
plus the helpfulness to the jury. It has to assist the trier.
But if
fact.
He doesn't have specialized knowledge, doesn't that then flow?
Well, first he has to have the specialized knowledge. Dr. Kondo didn't have the specialized knowledge.
So isn't that the end of the inquiry?
That should be the end of the inquiry.
Stop right there.
But also, even in this case, if it's not the end of the inquiry, the testimony that he offered in this bill of exception isn't helpful to the jury. It's not helpful to a jury for an expert witness to get up there and say magic words, namely in this case proximate cause, without any explanation, without any basis for it whatsoever.
But the world's best neurosurgeon, offered on a bill of exception that his study was that certain procedures should have been done, and if they'd been done, it would have resulted in a different outcome here. That would be excludable because it doesn't have enough detail to be helpful to the jury.
But you've added something to the equation, Your Honor. You've added what would have been done. Dr. Kondo doesn't know and didn't say what would have been done by a neurosurgeon if a neurosurgeon had been called in. So not only does he lack the specialized knowledge, but also his testimony is not helpful to the jury because all he gave the jury was a bald conclusion, approximate cause.
Why? As I understand the facts, Dr. Kondo's theory of why he should be allowed to testify, and the plaintiff's theory is that not only was he an emergency room physician, but he worked for years closely with neurosurgeons, and he knew the modus operandi, and therefore, any fool would have known, any emergency room physician would have known that working with surgeons that you do CAT scan for head injury under these symptoms.
He was allowed to testify
as to that,
that you do a CAT scan. He was allowed to testify that a neurosurgeon should have been called. What he was not allowed to testify about is whether a neurosurgeon could have saved her life, because he didn't know what a neurosurgeon would have done if he had been called. That's really where he crosses the line, when he gets into
and his association,
what the CAT scan would show, what the neurosurgeon would have done when he got there, and whether it would have worked. He's not qualified to talk about those things.
Why couldn't he testify to those matters if he had closely worked with neurosurgeons? Not that he was going to do it, but that he knew what could be done by somebody capable of specialized training.
He never claimed to know what the neurosurgeon would have done. He merely said that he had stabilized head injury patients, including stabilizing head injury patients on helicopters, being taken in by air ambulance from the scene of an accident or an assault or something. But that he would just turn the patient over to a neurosurgeon for treatment, that he was not involved in treating head injuries.
Judge Hartman said you can qualify to give an opinion about the standard of care, but you're not qualified to tell a jury what a neurosurgeon would have done. And that's where we are.
That's right. That's
right. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear arguments from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Weiner will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm David Weiner, counsel for the respondent, the Heisens, in this case. It was Emerson who said that this time, like all times, is a very good one, if we but know what to do with it. I think that the challenge for me here today is knowing what to do with the time that I have before the court. I don't believe that I can afford to stand here today and insist that Hart versus Van Zandt, which was decided 30 years ago by this court, provides a simple, quick, and complete answer to the issue that is presented. But nevertheless, I believe that Hart versus Van Zandt must be dealt with before the court can determine and articulate, as Justice Owen has noted, should be the case here, what the standard should be for determining an expert's qualifications in a medical malpractice case with respect to the issue of causation. The fact is that Hart versus Van Zandt did say exactly what the Court of Appeals said that it said. And it said that in a medical malpractice case, that in order to prove a case against a defendant doctor, The plaintiff must show through the testimony of a doctor of the same school of practice both negligence or the breach of standard of care and proximate cause. The court in Hart v. Van Zandt also made it quite explicit that the same school of practice means that if the defendant doctor is a medical doctor, it is sufficient that the expert witness is also a medical doctor.
Mr. Wine, in Hart, the expert was Dr. Scott, is that correct?
That's the expert.
Is it significant that the opinion states that Dr. Scott held an MD degree and was licensed to practice neurosurgery, which is exactly the same practice that Dr. Van Zandt had in Texas?
My understanding...
Is it significant in this case because Dr. Kondo was not a neurosurgeon?
I don't think it's significant because in Porter versus Perrier, which was also cited by the court in Hart versus Van Zandt, the same school of practice requirement was made very explicit as in distinguishing between typically doctors of medicine on the one hand and doctors of osteopath on the other hand. In fact, in Hart versus Van Zandt,
in the Perrier case, wasn't there evidence that both schools of medicine did exactly the same thing under the same circumstances, same practice, even though they were different schools?
Yes, that's true, and it was an exception to the same school of practice requirement. But I'm citing to the court, through Porter versus Perrier, for the fact that it made explicit what the same school of practice actually means. Now, there are exceptions to it, and what I'm saying in this case is that if we start off with Hart versus Van Zandt for the same school of practice requirement, it does appear to clearly hold that it is sufficient if the defendant doctor is a medical doctor that the expert witness is also a medical doctor. Now, the fact is, and I think the question is, is that same school of practice requirement not only necessary, as Hart versus Van Zandt indicates, but is it also sufficient? If it's necessary and sufficient, then it does appear to set forth a standard of error, such that if the expert witness is a medical doctor, that's all that's required. It is required, and that's all that's required, and therefore the court must admit the testimony. If, on the other hand, it is necessary but not sufficient, then we leave room for the trial court's discretion. And it appears that under modern medical practice, as well as under the rules of evidence that have been developed and enacted, frankly, since Hart versus Van Zandt was decided, that the question of determining a witness's, an expert witness's qualifications is one of discretion, one of the trial court's discretion, and the review standard is abuse of discretion standard. In addition, the case law...
So up to this point, you're not disagreeing with anything that the counsel, your opposing counsel has said?
I'm not explicitly disagreeing with anything that they've said. That's correct. Because I think that Rule 702, together with the case law that not only applies to Rule 702, but even apart from Rule 702, has said that the question of the qualifications of a medical doctor to testify is a question that is a matter of the trial court's discretion. So,
where do you draw an issue?
Well, I draw an issue on the application. I draw an issue on exactly what this court believes needs to be done with respect to Hart versus Van Zandt. Does the court...
If Hart versus Van Zandt can be read, that any doctor can testify about anything, whether or not it's in medicine, a general practitioner, so a doctor can testify about neurology or cancer or ophthalmology or whatever. If Van Zandt can be read for that broadly, you're saying leave it alone.
Well, I think it can be read broadly, but I don't believe that this court had granted the writ of error in this case to endorse the Court of Appeals in reaching that holding, if in fact that was how the court reads the basis for the Court of Appeals holding.
We do have a rule of evidence that's come into play since Van Zandt was written.
Yes, we do.
And whatever evidence is admitted or excluded come through the screen of those rules rather than through whatever common law cases we can find in our jurisprudence.
Well, it has to come through that, but I don't think that, however, that completely eliminates the precedential value and the stare decisis effect of common law decisions such as Hart versus Van Zandt. If I may point out, and admittedly, I'm standing here today entering into a dialogue with the court. I'm certainly an advocate for my client, but at the same time, I don't believe that I can take a hard line and advocate a position that I don't truly believe to be completely well-grounded, which would be the position that Hart versus Van Zandt is the first and the final word on the issue of an extra qualification. I am saying it's grounded. I just don't know that it's all that well-grounded. And the fact is, take what has happened with respect to the question of testimony as to the standard of care and breach of the standard of care. If that was ever governed by Hart versus Van, it has now certainly been legislatively supplanted by Article 4590I, Section 14.01, which sets forth quite specifically the standard that must be met in order for a witness to testify as to a doctor's testify both as to the standard of care that's applicable as well as to the breach of that standard of care. It seems to incorporate the same school of practice requirement that's in Hart versus Van Zandt, but it goes beyond that same school of practice requirement and in effect creates a heightened school of practice requirement, both in the version that was in effect at the time of this case was tried as well as the new version that just was passed by the legislature. So as to that aspect of the two prongs of medical malpractice must be proved, negligence, there's a legislative standard that we have now that we work with. But as to causation, the legislature didn't do anything. Didn't do anything originally, hasn't done anything now, and has left it either to the common law, as we have through Hart versus Van Zandt, the common law as we have it with the cases that say that an expert witness's qualifications, including those of a medical doctor to testify, are a question of to be determined within the trial court's discretion, and as a matter of the rules of civil evidence, namely Rule 702, which seems to mesh with and comport with the case law that talks about determination of qualifications as a matter of discretion.
If we were to apply Section 4590I, that standard that you describe as a heightened standard, to the causation prong in this case, what should the result be?
The version of Article 4590I that was in effect at the time of this case provided that the expert witness could testify on whether a physician departed from accepted standards of medical care only if the person was practicing at the time such testimony was given or was practicing at the time the claim arose and has knowledge of accepted standards of medical care for diagnosis, care, or treatment of the illness, injury, or condition involved in the claim. Now, frankly, if you look at that and it says, has knowledge of accepted standards of medical care for the diagnosis, care, treatment of the illness, or injury, or condition, I think that the testimony of Dr. Kondo would meet that standard that is legislatively set forth. And I think that the court can turn to that standard. I think that the court can borrow that standard from the legislature, even though, on the other hand, of course, you have the fact that the legislature has apparently made a conscious decision not to enact a standard with respect to the causation issue. But I think that this is certainly very instructive as to what should be a proper standard of care.
Swinger, let me ask you a question. What does it do to your argument when the Texas College of Emergency Physicians align themselves, you know, with opposing counsel in amicus brief, which clearly, to me, adopts the position taken by the hospital and the doctors for your suing, that to allow Dr. Kondo to testify as to causation with mere speculation, because he had no specialized training or knowledge as a neurosurgeon, particularly especially at best possible outcomes.
Well, obviously, they joined in that because they agree that a witness in a case like this has to either be a neurosurgeon or at least have some greater specialized knowledge of matters involving neurosurgery than Dr. Kondo had. I don't see any particular oddity in them joining in with that position. I suppose that they just want to see the best proof possible or the highest standard possible adopted before members of their group can be found responsible for their negligence, both with respect to their deviating from standard of care as well as the consequences of their deviation from standard of care.
Mr. Weiner, let's assume for a moment that a mere medical degree does not qualify an individual to express an opinion about a certain factual circumstance. What additional proof should be made to demonstrate that an individual is qualified to express an opinion? And I'm talking about this in the medical malpractice context. Let's assume for a moment that the mere possession of a medical degree isn't sufficient to qualify a person to express an opinion about a medical malpractice circumstance. What additional proof should be shown? And do you think that proof was demonstrated through Dr. Kondo?
I think that what has to be shown is some knowledge of the matter on which the witness is offering the testimony. That's, in this case, causation. Your question is couched in terms of assuming that it's not sufficient that the witness has a medical degree. But I take it that in your question, you do believe that it's necessary that the witness has a medical degree.
Well,
as some minimum or some threshold.
Well, for the purposes of our discussion, let's say that the medical degree is simply a shorthand adopted by the courts demonstrating educational achievement. The discussion between whether or not a medical doctor could testify against an osteopath or something, one has a medical degree, another one does not, that the degree is simply a shorthand of a comment that the educational, that in the medical context where we're going to require someone to have an educational background in medicine, the degree simply represents having achieved that. So for that purpose, let's assume that the degree itself is not necessary, but what's necessary is at least a threshold showing of education in that field.
Well, if that's the case, and it isn't that, and you say, as for the purpose of your question, it's not sufficient, still, it goes a long way towards establishing the qualification, because it does go a long way towards establishing the kind of specialized knowledge that the layman cannot be assumed to have, and that, therefore, the witness is in a position to help or assist the jury with. But what is sufficient is some knowledge of the particular matter upon which the witness is offering the testimony. Well,
you keep using the phrase, some knowledge. Is taking a course in medical school enough?
Well.
In that particular area. Let's say that the doctor you're supposed to put on has taken a course in neurosurgery, but he's never practiced in it. Simply taking a course in medical school adequate under your test.
Perhaps not, but if we come back to the facts of the case and to Dr. Kondo's qualifications, I don't know that I can offer the court a bright line rule as to exactly what would be sufficient. Frankly, if there were such a bright line rule, and in different points throughout this case and throughout this appeal, the defendants have offered such a bright line rule, claiming that Dr. Kondo couldn't testify because he was not a neurosurgeon. If there were such a bright line rule, I believe that that would equally eliminate the trial court's discretion, because that would create, again, an error standard that requires that the testimony be admitted if the witness were a neurosurgeon, and it would require exclusion of the evidence if the witness were not a neurosurgeon. But the fact is, in this case, if discretion is to play a part, and I don't think that there's any question that discretion is a key part of the analysis here. If discretion is to play a part, as applied to Dr. Kondo, it wasn't that he just learned about neurosurgery and neurosurgical matters in medical school, but that he'd been working in an environment for years and years as an emergency room physician around head injury patients. He had, as he testified, he worked closely with neurosurgeons in these matters. He knew what neurosurgeons do. Now, I know that that's not to say that there might be another case in which a witness with less experience, less involvement, or less knowledge might not be qualified.
Yeah, but that's not the problem at issue here. He was allowed to testify to the standard of care, or he was not allowed to testify or speculate what's just the causation, whether early intervention would have made any difference.
Correct.
And why don't you focus on that?
Correct. Well, I'm focusing on that because I'm saying that these things that I point out, his having worked in this area and worked closely with neurosurgeons and stating that he had knowledge about what neurosurgeons did and could do, was sufficient to show that he was qualified on the issue of causation. Now, the defendants take the position that all he did was offer this conclusory opinion about proximate cause. But the narrow issue is his qualification, not really the factual basis that he had for the opinion. The bill of exceptions was offered after the objection had been sustained to Dr. Kondo's testimony on causation because of his supposed lack of qualification. So the point of the bill of exceptions was to show that he had qualifications, not to show the factual basis that he would have had for his testimony. That, under Rules 703 and 704 and 705, could have been brought out by the defendant on cross-examination had, that is, the factual basis for his opinion, had the testimony been admitted.
Was Dr. Kondo qualified to treat head injuries, drawing the distinction between an emergency room context stabilizing a head injury versus the neurosurgeon's context of treating a head injury?
No, he didn't claim that he was qualified to actually treat head injuries himself. But he had been around it enough, he had worked closely enough with it, and knew enough about it that he was qualified to express an opinion as to what neurosurgeons could have done. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Martin, would it have been enough here if Dr. Kondo had been a neurosurgeon? Would you lose if he had been a neurosurgeon?
Probably. If he had been a neurosurgeon who had experience practicing as a neurosurgeon and who was knowledgeable about and knew how to treat somebody with a deep laceration in the white matter of their brain that's not visible on a CT scan.
Let me try to ask a better question. I think my question wasn't what I meant to ask exactly. Under Hart Van Zandt, the argument is that perhaps someone with just a medical degree ought to be able to testify to all matters involving medical knowledge. Are you arguing for a narrowing of that rule that all the trial court need to determine is whether the physician who seeks to testify is a specialist or a subspecialist in the same area in which they offer their testimony? Or are you offering for more nuance than that?
Well, first of all, Justice Cornyn, I don't think that's what Hart versus Van Zandt holds. I don't think Hart versus Van Zandt holds that an MD can testify about any medical subject. And it was really not until this case, 30 years later, that any court thought that it did. We've got two excellent decisions out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, Roberson and Milkey, which articulate a very clear rule that the expert witness must have knowledge about the specific medical technical subject that's involved in that case. And so I think that...
So you are not arguing that all is required is that they be members of the same subspecialty? You're saying
no,
they must have
no,
particular
in fact,
knowledge?
In fact, that's a good point. The basis for our objection really was not and is not the same school of practice type of objection that one might have made back before Rule 702 and looking at cases like Bowles against Borden and Porter and Hart versus Van Zandt. Our objection is really based on lack of qualifications under Rule 702 of the Texas Rules of Evidence.
I have two more quick questions.
Sure.
One, is this necessarily, if your argument prevails, will result in a proliferation of expert witnesses in medical cases, won't it? Because unless we allow, let's say, an internist to testify about orthopedic injuries and that sort of thing, you're going to have to call an orthopedic surgeon to testify about orthopedic injuries, perhaps a gastroenterologist about some other aspect of the case, a neurosurgeon about some other.
I don't agree with that at all, Your Honor. I can tell you that in many malpractice cases, experts are called to deal today with the specific medical issues involved. After all, we've got two Dallas Court of Appeals decisions that, at least in my part of the state, we've been relying on for years. That say that's the law. Unfortunately, this case, although tried in Dallas, got transferred under docket equalization to another jurisdiction. So I don't see it as a proliferation of experts. What I see is better civil justice for this state by requiring that experts be qualified to know what they're talking about before they come into court. We're talking about a man here who failed his medical boards twice, lied about it when he came to court, and said he only failed them once. We're talking about a man who could not be admitted to any medical school in the United States. We're talking about a man who admits unashamedly if the law firm that represented the plaintiffs at trial, he says, quote, if they need me, I'm available. And there's too much expert witness abuse going on in the civil justice system in this state. The courts, this court, I believe in your concurring or dissenting opinion in the Easy Mart case, Havner versus Easy Mart, and Chief Justice Phillips also commented about the proliferation of unscientific expert testimony in those cases. And really, I think this is an important case for that reason. I think.
Are you arguing, as I understand your argument, you are not arguing for a bright line rule. You're arguing in favor of the trial court's discretion.
I'm in favor of the trial court having a reasonable amount of discretion. Certainly the trial court can abuse that discretion. As I indicated earlier, I think if Judge Hartman had allowed this gentleman to testify about cause and fact in this case, that would have been abuse of discretion. But there are many other cases where it would be within the trial court's discretion to let it in or to keep it out. And I think that's...
Ms. Martin, I'm talking about assuming that it's more... That this knowledge has to be about the specific subject matter, which it was in the Milky case. So this person has to know about treating head injuries. How do we get substance to the statement they have to have specialized knowledge about the specific subject matter? Dr. Kondo says, I went to medical school, I learned how to treat brain injuries in medical school.
You didn't say that.
Well, it said he had the same training that the other doctor had and he dealt with head injuries, didn't it?
No, I don't believe that's correct at all. He said he went to medical school, that he was made some vague statement about being taught about head injuries, but we've got
okay, we've got
the amicus briefs, we've got the testimony from Dr. Sampson and Dr. Weiner. They go through 5 extra years of specialized training in neurosurgery. There's no evidence from Dr. Kondo that he knows about the type of injury that this young woman
has,
or that he knows what a neurosurgeon would have done if he'd been called in.
I understand that comes at the other end. My comment is drafting this rule on dealing with specialized knowledge. Is the specialized, where, what's the threshold on specialized knowledge? At what point is specialized knowledge make an abuse of discretion to allow the testimony in, or an abuse of discretion to kick it out? What we go beyond simply being having medical school, medical training. We now move into an area of subject matter treating head injuries. What's the, what would be a threshold for saying this is sufficient knowledge? Do they have to have sufficient knowledge to be able to treat, or could I be just simply assist in, for 10 years, assist in treating brains? I've just never bothered to get qualified as a quote-unquote neurosurgeon, but I've assisted in treating brain injuries. Is that not enough, or is that enough?
I would argue that just watching somebody else do it isn't enough. I might watch a real estate lawyer close a deal. That doesn't make me qualified to go close the next one. By knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education, he has to have specialized knowledge of the very medical subject matter that's involved in the case. And I'm not sure you can, you know, the legislature's tried to draw a rule, as Justice Owen asked about, with regard to standard of care. That piece of legislation does not apply to the causation issue. But I'm not sure you can draw any more of a bright line test. And now, I realize my time's up. I do want to just make the point. I disagree with his answer with regard to 4590I. I don't think Dr. Kondo is qualified under the old 4590I, even if that provision applied to causation. He certainly would not be qualified under the new one, because one of the factors the court is bound to consider is whether he's board certified or not.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.